From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's college admissions time. The letters are coming. Tensions run high, especially high, it turns out, in Asian American households. Many Asian Americans do well in school, very well. Top scores, top grades. But some worry that as a group, they're being penalized for that performance, that top schools, worried about having too many Asian Americans, are quietly holding down their admissions, raising the bar for Asian Americans. This hour on Point, college admissions and the Asian American factor. You can join the conversation. Asian Americans, is there an issue here? What do you see? We start today with Carolyn Chen, director in Asian American Studies at Northwestern University, where she's also a professor of sociology. She joins us from Evanston, Illinois. In December, she wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times headlined, Asians Too Smart for Their Own Good. Carolyn Chen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I'm looking at the essay that you wrote, Carolyn. It caught our attention then, and it just took us a little while to get around to it, and I'm sorry for that. But you point out, very high in your essay, that Asian Americans, if you look at the whole population of the country, Asian Americans constitute 5.6% of the U.S. population, but they make up 12 to 18% of the student body at Ivy League schools. 5.6% of the overall population, 12 to 18% at Ivy League schools. A lot of people might look at those numbers, Carolyn, and say, what's the problem from your perspective? That's already way out of proportion to their representation in the society itself. So what's the problem?
Yes, exactly. I think that what I argue is actually seems quite counterintuitive, and I argue that Asian Americans are actually underrepresented at many of these elite selective private universities. You know, when we think about the question of proportionality, if we think about Jews are about 25% of the Ivy League population. However, in the general population, they represent less than 2%. So there, you know, there we see that there are, for other groups, there are they are not necessarily proportionally represented in schools. However, we don't take note of that because Jews are white. We don't notice their racial difference. Now,
Can I just make sure I've got those numbers? You're saying Jews overall, maybe 2-something% of the American population?
Under 2%,
and, okay,
yes.
And, and they make up 25% of Ivy League student bodies?
Yes, about 25%, yes.
Okay, so if Asian Americans are 5 or 6% of the overall population, but only 12 to 18% of those elite school populations, what are you suggesting they might constitute if they, I don't know, if there were no special impediment? We'll talk about what that might be.
Yeah, you know, I'm not really sure what that number would be. But I know that if we do look at other schools, which particularly very selective public universities, which do not weigh subjective factors as highly and that do not have as many preferential policies that advantage particularly white middle-class students, you'd see a place like UC Berkeley, which is about 40% Asian American. Now, this might not be the case. I mean, there are a large number of Asian Americans in California,
sure.
So that might not be the case everywhere else. But, you know, my larger argument about why Asian Americans are underrepresented at these schools is that Asian Americans have, on average, higher SAT scores, and they also have more leadership positions than white students. And yet we're finding that they are being admitted in, you know, that they're admitted in lower numbers than white students.
What's your theory of how this comes to pass? If they have higher grade point averages,
yeah.
higher SAT scores, and you're saying more prominent leadership positions, why then would they not be even more heavily represented at campuses that presumably care a lot about those things?
Yeah, you know, I think that there are a number of reasons for this. I think that one, that that Asian students are facing a bias because of the stereotype of them as math geeks, as being one-dimensional, as being just brainy and just you know, studying all the time. And so that when selective universities have far more applicants that, you know, that have the test scores and that could get in, then they actually have spots for these students. So they're very selective. And so that when these schools are looking for students who are individuals, who are creative, who are unique, and Asian Americans are stereotyped as being one-dimensional. They're all the same. They play the piano, they play the violin, and they're really good at math. And so those kinds of stereotypical biases actually hurt them when they are, you know, it starts from the very letters that are being written about them by their college counselors, about their, by their high school, by their high school teachers. It hurts when admissions officers are reading these very applications, because we know that stereotypes make a difference. How could we expect these admissions officers who are humans not to be able to, you know, not to also give in to these stereotypes? There's also a number of factors that are very much race neutral, okay, that are built into the admissions policy that selectively and systematically disadvantage Asian Americans, but not only Asian Americans, but all immigrants, all minorities, and all people who don't come from upper middle class or upper middle class backgrounds or go to private high schools. One of these is the preferential policy that's given to legacies.
Applicants whose parents may have attended that university.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, so children of alumni. And they get an extra thumb on the scale. We know that students from Harvard and Princeton are, you know, they're admitted at three times the rate of, legacies are admitted at three times the rate of regular students. Mm-hmm. We also know that athletes, and Asian Americans are not as represented in the legacy pool. We also know that special preferences are given to athletes, and they get an extra thumb on the scale. The admissions rates at Harvard for an athlete was almost 50%. You know, you had a 1 in 2 chance of getting in if you were a recruited athlete. And Asian Americans are also not represented in that pool. We know that there's a special advantage given to children of very wealthy donors. Okay, so if you can give $5 million or $10 million, you can be guaranteed a spot. And Asian Americans, again, aren't represented in these areas among this population. Another thing, we know that Asian Americans, by and large, are going to public schools. And these college counselors are not necessarily counseling. They don't have the time and resources to counsel them in the same way that students who are going to very selective and elite private schools have that opportunity. I was recently talking to a college counselor at a private school, and she was telling me that when she works with her Asian American applicants, she works extra hard to make sure that her applicants have personalities that shine, that they seem like that they are not just good academically, but they are intellectual, that they're interested in research, you know, that they are interested in art history.
What's wrong with putting that forward? Is that a problem?
It's not a problem, but the fact, that's not a problem at all. In fact, you know, well-rounded students, that's a very good thing. But I think that the emphasis is that she has to work extra hard in putting that forward, because she knows that Asian Americans face a bias, that they are not perceived in those ways. So it's about learning how to frame yourself. However, she's a college counselor at a very, you know, at an expensive private school, okay? And if you're going to a public school, which is where most Asian American students, where they attend, they don't have that kind of privilege or those kinds of services. If you want to hire an independent college counselor that will help you with writing your essay, will help you with, you know, kind of planning out your extracurricular activities, your leadership activities, starting from when you're a freshman in high school, you're going to have to pay about $20,000 for 2 years.
And that's a tiny percentage of overall applicants who pay that kind of money, not just Asian Americans, but for all applicants. That must not be common.
Right. But a disproportionate number of those applicants are getting into these selective schools.
What's the principle that you're fighting for here? Is this about race and prejudice? Is it about meritocracy? What's the principled complaint you're making?
You know, I think that that's a really great question that you're asking here. I think that there are a number of things that are going on here. I mean, I think that the more that I think about this topic, I think that I'm not sure that admissions at selective universities will ever be based on meritocracy. I mean, the way that I think more about universities now is not really as not as institutions where you get a, you know, you get a, the people who have the highest score get in, but rather that these are exclusive clubs. These are exclusive clubs, these are exclusive communities where they're composed of largely very smart people, but whose membership really depends on what these people bring to that community. And that and those institutional goals may very well be in opposition to meritocracy or to fairness.
What are the implications of that, though, for the American ideal if these are not meritocracies at the top of our academic pyramid, but rather exclusive clubs, as you suggest?
Well, I think that there are a lot of implications for this. We need to remember that these selective universities are gateways to the elite. And what I think that we're seeing here is a story of the exclusion of a new group, of a certain group, to the elite. I mean, the elite has for a long time been populated by white Anglo-Saxon Protestant males, right? And what we're seeing
more than that, if your numbers are correct on other groups as well in Ivy League representation, 25% Jewish.
Right, but it's largely been white. Okay, and what we're seeing historically has been white. And what we're really seeing here is a change in a dramatic change in the demographic population of the United States.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking at college admissions time about Asian Americans complaining they have higher scores and lower admission rates and wanting to know why. Carolyn Chen is with us. She's director in Asian American Studies at Northwestern University. Joins us today from Evanston, Illinois. She wrote an essay about this a couple of months ago. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us. Asian American listeners, do you feel the college admission system is rigged against you, your children? Are Asian American kids getting the grades but not the acceptance letters? Are there other factors, the well-rounded student profile, that could hold down Asian American numbers? Or is that just a smokescreen of some kind, a way to keep white and other admissions up? Admissions officers, what do you make of the Asian American complaint? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. We'll hear in just a moment from an Asian American who was also an admissions officer at several top American universities. A couple of calls first. Debbie in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Debbie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My daughter was a victim of this very phenomenon. She's Korean, adopted at 3 months, has been a straight-A student her entire high school career. At age 15, she had a job, the 15-16 summer, she had a job in a biology lab at UMass, got absolutely glowing reports from the lab director. She was valedictorian, national merit scholar, captain of the volleyball team, played the saxophone in the band, voted class speaker, great test scores, did community service, and she did not get into her top four schools. She did not get into Harvard, Northeastern, University of Rochester, or Rochester Institute of
Technology. You know, Debbie, I want to hear you out, but with respect, a lot of families at admissions time end up, I think, feeling that way, like, gosh, you know, my kid was amazing, but didn't get in where they wanted to go. Not any of the top four. What makes you think that this was related to her ethnic origin?
Because we found out later on the application process, when there was an option of checking race in the box, she put Asian. And I think that, and I've been from Massachusetts, and I think probably it has to do with class balance. If she was everything she is but was from Montana, you know, she might have gotten into these schools. But it really seemed like what more could they possibly be looking for?
Debbie, I appreciate your call. Carolyn, if Debbie's adopted Korean daughter had been white and from Montana with that kind of background, do you think it might have been a different outcome?
Yeah, I think it really could have been a very different outcome, because schools are looking for geographic diversity, and there is a disproportionate disproportionate number of very, very smart students who are coming from Massachusetts, but not only smart students, smart Asian American students. And so we see that, you know, again, this is where Asian Americans are systematically, there's a systematic bias against them because they are by and large immigrants and they are and they reside in the most populated states and most populated cities. So they are, you know, so they are in the most competitive pools.
Let's go to Steve in Florence, South Carolina. Steve, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm okay.
I have a little problem with this. I mean, she alluded to the fact that legacies, people with money can get their kids in school. Obviously, affirmative action kids can get in school. Athletes can get in school.
Yes.
What percentage would you think is appropriate for the brilliant Asian American? We have brilliant every race in this country. And I think, given the numbers that you cited at the beginning, they do quite well, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't see them being discriminated against. These people have to balance their books as far as being available to 300 million people instead of 2 million people.
Mm-hmm.
That's my comment.
Steve, I appreciate it very much. Carolyn, that brings us back to what principles are we working with here? I mean, you know, Steve points out all kinds of privileging or balancing or affirmatively acting that we do with certain goals in mind. So, his question is, how much is enough, madam?
You know, I think that that's an excellent question and one that I actually don't have an answer to. I think that this is a question that we really need to be asking the American population, and that the American population needs to be asking and really demanding answers from these selective universities, because their admissions process is so opaque. I actually think that they need to be more accountable to the public.
But what do you think the public is going to want? Let's say if you did it purely on scores and, you know, sort of top line activities, as you're suggesting, that instead of, 12 to 18% Asian, it was 40% Asian, like
right.
Berkeley.
Right.
Do you think the American public would say that's cool?
You know what? I don't know, but I have a feeling that they don't think that it's cool, and that's part of the reason why there aren't 40% Asian Americans at these schools. And that to me, suggests racial bias or discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is, we need to remember this is not a new story for Americans or for selective universities at all. This was happening in the 1920s. For Jews in the Ivy Leagues as well. In the 1920s, the number of Jews at Harvard had risen over 25%, and there was a Jewish problem in these schools. Jerome Carabel, a sociologist at Berkeley, writes about this. And there were schools like Columbia where the percentage of Jews was even higher, and what they were experiencing was what they called WASP flight. Okay, and so Harvard, Princeton, and Yale really didn't want that problem of WASP flight, not just because, you know, they felt like Jews, you know, they had an institutional incentive for keeping their base there because they were largely their donors, they were largely their supporters. And so I think that that's, you know, I think that there are these issues that are very much about politics that have nothing to do with meritocracy, that are influencing and shaping the decisions that these institutions make.
Of course, I mean, I've got listeners online. Here's one who says, minorities complaining that merit isn't being considered for admission. Really? That's rich. You'll have some white listeners who will think, well, look, white applicants have made way for, let's say, affirmative action for years now in the interest of a better balance on our campuses. And maybe thinking, so get in line, Asian Americans. You're not the first one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and very much, and you know, again, if we look at the admissions policies of universities, they systematically advantage upper middle class whites. I mean, that's just, and legacies are just a great example of that, right? It's reproducing the class and racial hierarchy of these schools and of the nation. And so we need to remember that these systematic advantages, these preferential policies, not only disadvantage Asian Americans, but they disadvantage, you know, all immigrant groups, working class whites. They also disadvantage blacks and Latinos. But because of affirmative action, race-conscious affirmative action, we do see that there's sort of a balance to that systematic preference for upper-middle-class whites that we don't have for Asian Americans. And so really here, I think that the real one of the ways to really deal with this problem, mm-hmm. I mean, we could change our definitions of merit. We can change, you know, we can change what are the criteria for admissions. But I think a really important thing here is actually what's lacking is the political voice and political visibility of Asian Americans. I mean, when we think about Jews, the exclusions, the quotas that were against Jews in the 1920s, well, those got reversed when Jews actually gained political power, when they gained political visibility.
Mm-hmm. Spoke
and they
up.
Were, yeah, when they spoke up, and then when they were demanding, different kinds of criteria for admission to these universities.
It's going to be a very interesting century as we move into a new mix overall, demographically, population-wise, and these kind of numbers and dynamics flow in new directions. Carolyn Chen, stand by in Evanston, Illinois. I want to go to somebody who's been inside this process for some insight here. With us right now from Denver, Colorado, is Rod Bugarin. Asian-American, Filipino-American, born in Hawaii, spent more than 15 years in the admissions offices at selective schools, Wesleyan Brown, Columbia. He's currently an advisor with Aristotle Circle. It helps students navigate the admissions process at selective high schools and colleges. He wrote a response to your Times essay, Carolyn. His was headlined, "Scores Aren't the Only Qualification." Rod, thanks very much for joining us today.
Tom, thank you for having me.
So give us the view from inside the admissions office. You were there for a long time. Here come, you know, these high scores, GPAs and SAT scores on Asian American applications. And Asian American families saying, come on, you know, our kids worked hard. They've really applied themselves. They've done well. And they want into top schools. Why aren't they getting in? You know, is there a special headwind for them?
Right. Well, the challenge is, and unless someone has worked behind the scenes, is that until you see the full depth of the applicant pool at any one of these colleges, you realize that 90% of the students are phenomenal in every possible way. And what the public needs to know, and you know, I hope Carolyn recognizes this, is that admissions officers respond to the needs of faculty, students, and staff at our universities. And so when we take a look at the applicant pool, we are trying to find multiple versions of diversity. We are going above and beyond race, class, geography to really find those individuals that can bring something new, a new voice to our campuses. And when we submit our admissions letters, then we hope that those students who decide to take up our offer, as a former admissions officer, then those students will come and create this community of individuals where there is a critical mass of diversity of people being able to see someone who looks like them and someone who's very, very different. And so, you know, we don't have any numbers. We don't have any minimum, maximum things that we look for. We're trying to create this community, which is highly subjective. And luckily, you know, it's a human process where multiple people weigh in their factors based on their experiences. And so, you know, it is an imperfect science, as many veteran admissions officers will say at highly selective institutions.
Is that, when you look at the final numbers at the end of all that, is that a fancy way of saying, yes, we discriminate?
I disagree with that term. I mean, because we do take a look at multiple factors, we are considering, you know, more than just objective factors like test scores and grades. And we do have to make really tough decisions as to why one student is better than another.
Carolyn is focused on the history of how these things have unfolded in this country. She looks back to the Jewish experience of the 20s, where subjective criteria were used, in her view, to discriminate against Jewish applicants. And now she looks around at Ivy League schools. She's 25% Jewish enrollment from a, you know, population that's 2% of the country's overall population. She looks at Asian Americans, says 5% of the country's population, but, you know, only 12 to 18% of Ivy League enrollment. And she sees discrimination there. Do you?
I think it would be very interesting to take a look at who actually applies to these schools. I mean, Carolyn would know the factors that really influence which students apply to these highly selective institutions.
You think Asian Americans don't apply?
Well, and that's the point that I'm trying to make, Tom, mm-hmm. is that the depth of the applicant pool in these particular populations, students from private schools, are definitely overrepresented. And so the joy of the admissions office and what we do is to try to find those students where we can balance things out, where those students who feel that this process might be unfair to them because of race, because of income, because of their parental background, that they're given a fair shot. And to know that when they come to a place like where I worked before, Columbia, that they mm-hmm. will take full advantage of the opportunities that are available to them there. So,
are you suggesting that Asian Americans as a group might not take full advantage of the opportunities available at a university like Columbia?
Oh, no, that's not what I'm suggesting at all. It's just that, you know, when we're trying to take a look at who applies and what community we want to create, is that we do have to make some really difficult decisions as to what the optimal composition of the student body should be.
Kind of community we want to create. What does that mean? I mean, this is an interesting century in which to grapple with that. Do you mean you want it to look a certain way? And does that mean don't look too Asian?
Well, we want it to be able to have multiple perspectives. And so I think for any student, and this is the point of what I wrote in the New York Times, is that, you know, when students come to a college campus, for example, they would feel highly uncomfortable if everybody at that college, particularly a private world-class university, would see that everybody's from their high school. Mm-hmm. And they would be like, why am I working so hard to basically repeat my high school experience? That they want to meet someone new, that they want to have a roommate who has a different political perspective, that they want to mm-hmm. Be able to go out with someone who has seen the world in a very different way, who has different academic interests, different artistic interests. And these go above and beyond test scores. These goes above and beyond cultural backgrounds. You know, and that's why these colleges, I mean, we work so hard on reading their essays and reading their recommendations. And if you take a look at any college application, we all have these supplemental essays to really get a sense of who the student is, as opposed to these objective measures that parents tend to cling to as definitions of merit solely.
Carolyn Chin, does that sound like a fair playing field to you?
I think on the face of it, it sounds like a fair playing field. And I should say that I'm not for a college admissions process that looks merely at numbers and test scores and grades. But I think that we need to really ask the question here of, when they think about who creating a proper community or the best community, you know, whose point of view is that and whose interests are being served when you're composing that population? And we need to remember here again that, Jerome Carabell in his book, he quotes a former Princeton admissions officer, director actually, who looks at admissions as trying to please various interest groups in the university. And Rod alluded to this as well, you know, that there's faculty, there's alumni, and there's all these different interest groups who are sort of grappling for, you know, we want this particular, you know, the coaches want this particular student, the alumni want their children in there, right? And so all these different interest groups want their particular representative in there. Mm-hmm. And I think that, again, when I talk about political power, political visibility, that's where Asian Americans don't have really much of a voice. There's nothing at stake for universities if they lower the number of Asian Americans. I mean, there would be something at stake if, say, it were illegal. There would be something at stake if Asian American alumni raised their voices. There would be something at stake if, you know, Asian American advocacy groups, you know, started shaming these universities. But we don't have that.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. At college admissions time, we're talking about Asian Americans complaining they have higher scores and lower admission rates, and they want to know why. It gets into all kinds of interesting questions about power and privilege and place in American society. Carolyn Chen is with us from Evanston, Illinois, director in Asian American Studies at Northwestern, wrote an essay entitled "Asians Too Smart for Their Own Good?" For the New York Times a couple of months ago. She's with us today. Rod Bugarin is with us, spent 15 years in admissions offices at highly selective schools, Wesleyan, Brown, Columbia. He's with the Aristotle Circle now and giving us some perspective from inside the sort of boiler room where these decisions are made. Let me go to Justina in Bloomington, Indiana. Justina, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have a really practical question. Mm-hmm. I have a child who is biracial. She's half Asian and half white.
Okay.
And I want to know, come application time, which box should she check? Which will give her the greatest advantage?
Interesting. Carolyn, do you have a thought on that?
Such an interesting question, because so many people are asking me that. All of the Asian American alumni at Northwestern are asking that question. And, you know,
Should our child reveal or not that he or she's Asian American, or should she or he or she disguise it?
Should our child reveal? Should the student reveal?
Because you could do the you don't have to answer that at all.
You don't have to answer it at all.
Okay.
Yes. And I think that it's a really hard, it's a hard question to answer, because I do, I think on one level I don't feel good about telling people not to reveal their race or ethnicity, because I think that that information is really important for the university. It's really important for demographics and really thinking about how our country is, measuring how our country is changing. But on the other hand, I think that having, even if you don't check that box, that if you do not declare your race, oftentimes your surname will give away your race, and
sure.
I just can't discount that there is some kind of bias on the part of admissions officers when they are reading those applications. I mean, this was very clear, and really the most comprehensive report that we have or a study of admissions is the Office of Civil Rights Investigation of Harvard that was completed in 1990. And in that report, they say that admissions officers do write things like, another Asian student who wants to go to medical school. This student, tends to be quiet and studious. Those are remarks, those are stereotypes that affect them. But on the other hand, that Asians are being affected by policies, admissions policies in schools that are really, on the face of it, race neutral, but however, disproportionately disadvantage Asians. So that by, by not checking the box, you're still going to be, Asian Americans are disproportionately still going to be disadvantaged simply because they are immigrants, for example.
Though in Justina's case, in Bloomington, Indiana, with an adopted, a half Asian parentage child, I don't know what the surname is. Mm-hmm. If the surname doesn't give it away, if it was your choice, Would you check Asian American or not?
Mm-hmm. This is a really, really tough question,
yeah.
And I think that this is it's such a tough question.
Deep issues
I think it's
of pride and openness.
Right, exactly.
And
I think it's a very personal matter. I think you need to just use your best judgment on that.
Rod, you've used the metaphor of Noah's Ark when talking about how admissions officers look at who should be admitted to top schools. What do you mean with that metaphor? How's that work?
Right. In the same way that we need to have multiple animals on a campus community. And so if we had only one zebra, would it be the same kind of community? Or we had those kind of things. And so, and that's the joy about, the admissions offices, that we're trying to find what's missing. And every year when I used to read applications, that would be the primary goal, is that when I look at an application, and going back to the caller from Bloomington, it's not a question of checking off a box that really matters, because there's so many factors that we take a look at when reviewing an application. And in fact, if you ask anyone who currently works at these admissions offices, we're trying to find reasons to admit you, not trying to find reasons to deny you, because the quality of the pool is so strong. And it's always that X factor that comes into play. So if you check the box, if you don't check the box, there's a lot of other things I can look to either admit you or to find reasons to deny you, because somebody else within your applicant pool is going to do something a little bit better. And I think that's the thing that's really important to really understate here, is that we're trying to compare apples to apples, oranges to oranges. And that goes back to the Noah's Ark analogy. And so, you know, and that's an issue of equity.
But apples to apples would mean scores, I would think, and numbers. This can easily slip back to, Carolyn writes in the 20s, how there were factors that were used to hold down Jewish enrollment. You know, they talk about character or vigor or leadership. I wonder how you see admissions officers looking at that. When Carolyn quotes those who are saying, oh boy, here we go, another Asian American who wants to go to medical school, or, you know, quiet or studious, is there a sense among admissions officers that if we have too many Asian Americans, and I well understand that that's a very broad term, nevertheless, that we'll have a student body that's too quiet or too studious or too bound for medical school or not rambunctious enough to ask, I don't know, outrageous questions? Is it that kind of concern, Rod?
If we went purely on these objective measures without taking a look at the subjective measures that come from recommendations, interviews, essays, you know, that's my fear, honestly, as a former admissions officer, yes, that we're looking at the black and white as opposed to the color of an applicant. And going back to your question about, you know, apples to apples, we do take a look at students based on the communities they come from. I mean, if I go to Exeter up in New Hampshire versus going to rural high school in Iowa, you know, we're going to get very different experiences, even though we could be from the same race. You know, and that's what we take a look at much more keenly than anything else. If my mother is a single mother and both of my parents are physicists at MIT, we're going to get, as a student, I'm going to develop very differently. And so these are things that are, you know, as Carolyn says, race neutral, but we do consider these factors much more highly than checking off a box on the first part of the application.
I want to go to California now, if we may, and David Hollinger. He is professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley. He's been there since 1992. There's a very high Asian American enrollment at Berkeley. Professor Hollinger, David Hollinger, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, glad to be on board.
So what is the percentage now of Asian Americans at UC Berkeley?
Well, it's been going up. We're now actually over 50% of our incoming freshmen are Asian American. 43% are self-identified Asian Americans. And then we now have 13% of our freshmen that we call international, but overwhelmingly these are Asian ethnics, many of whom have spent a lot of time in California already.
Yeah.
So we're well over 50% out here.
That's an amazing number. How do you then look at, if you've got 50% plus in that category, how do you look at elite schools, let's say on the East Coast or elsewhere, that have also lots of applicants like you, but end up with, you know, I don't know, 16-17% Asian? Does it look to you like it must?
It's partly that, you know, there are more Asians in California. We got something like 9% of the California population is Asian. We also have very strong commercial standing. Carolyn was talking earlier about, you know, different kinds of class position, and you know, a lot of the biggest donors to UC Berkeley are Chinese and Japanese business people and Korean business people. So the class situation is very different out here. I should also point out that 69% of our freshmen have at least one foreign-born parent.
Wow!
And that's not only from Asia, but that's, you know, like Mexico, Ukraine,
yeah,
Greece. So Berkeley has, as we used to say when I was young, broken on through to the other side. So our situation out here is really quite different from what you've been describing.
What's your admissions? What are your criteria? Is it scores only? Do you have these same subjective criteria?
We do it very much. I mean, I'm not on the admissions committee, mm-hmm. although I had served on it a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We do it very much just as Rod has described, and try to take a whole lot of different kinds of things into account. So, for example, when we look at our applicant pool, okay, it's only 31% self-identified Asian Americans, but yet we accept 43% of self-identified Asian Americans. So we actually accept a greater percentage. Speaking to, you know, Carolyn's concern that a lot of admissions people are getting, a lot of Asian applicants are not accepting them. We take a lot of them here. The campus style is not nervous about this, I would say. There's some anxiety on the part of what we might call Anglo alums, mm-hmm. that a lot of their children are not getting in, that the legacy stuff has been cut back so much here in the interest of merit.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some concern about that. But, you know, when I go into a class, I mean, I'll have 30, 40, 50% Asian American faces out there if I pay attention to it, but I don't. I mean, that we've made such a transition out here, people are just not very conscious of it, at least my colleagues on the faculty.
Has it changed the character of the campus culture in or the academic culture in any way that you perceive, David Harvey?
Well, I used to think it might, but actually it hasn't. And I was comparing notes the last couple of days with some of my colleagues on this, and they don't think so either. I mean, for example, our humanities and social science majors are going strong. And we got lots of people whose ancestry is Korean or Taiwanese or Chinese or Bangladeshi or whatever in those majors. So it's not the case that, you know, the stereotype that Caroline has been talking about, Caroline's been talking about, is a reality in the society. I'm not saying that that stereotype isn't there. I'm just saying that I don't see behavior here that's very consistent with it. Sure, we've got lots of Asian American engineers, okay, but, you know, I teach a course on the intellectual history of the United States since 1865,
mm-hmm.
a very humanities course, you know, reading lots of
sure.
Scott Fitzgerald and William James and that kind of stuff. And, you know, I have these Chinese American students who write papers on, you know, Henry James is the Golden Bull, something like that.
Yeah.
Very Anglo-topic. So
yeah.
They come in and out of it. So I'm fairly complacent about this.
Well, let me ask
California
you,
point of view.
On another aspect in Berkeley, another stereotype and more has been that it was a hotbed of social protest. Is that the same, or has that changed as this demographic has risen?
It has changed, and there are a lot of reasons for that. You could argue that a largely immigrant population does not feel the same sense of proprietary ownership of the society as the sort of folks around here in the 60s, and I was in the free speech movement, so I remember that very vividly. You could argue that, and that immigrant populations are less likely to be politically active, but if you look at the whole country, there are a lot of changes there. It's not just that Berkeley mm-hmm. doesn't have as much student activism as it once did, but there are whole different sets of issues, other kinds of things in the political economy and in global circumstances. So I wouldn't put too much emphasis on that, although I would say that there's something to that. There's something to the idea that an immigrant population is going to be less eager to overturn the whole thing and more eager to be part of it, whereas the gang that I was part of back in the 60s, we felt we owned a society and it was ours to change.
Carolyn Chen in Evanston, Illinois, if this came in your direction, the direction you'd like to see it go in, what's your sense of what that would mean for white Americans? We hear a lot about tiger moms and Asian families where kids study really hard and we see test scores that are high. Mm-hmm. I mean, are we talking here, you know, I saw somewhere in my reading for this hour that something like 4% of Jewish American college-age kids are in these highly selective schools. 1%, I think, of Asians. 0.01% of white Americans. What are the implications for white Americans if that trend continues?
Well, I think that for one thing, yes, it raises the bar for everyone. I think absolutely, I think that's true. It raises the bar for everyone. I think that, and, you know, understandably so, that whites might feel threatened by Asians. I mean, they haven't had this kind of competition, and here's a new group that's coming in and competing. We need to remember that these spots in these universities, these are scarce resources, and they're highly prized resources, and to seeing a new group take, you know, these very desirable spots is very threatening. But I do think that we need to remember here that, you know, I really don't want to perpetuate the tiger mom stereotype or that myth, because I think that we need, which is the idea that Asians are striving because of their culture. I think that we need to remember that these Asian Americans, the overwhelming majority who come from immigrant families, that they are putting so much value on their education, because this is the precise opportunity structure of the United States. This is their ticket to upward mobility. This is their vehicle mm-hmm. for mobility. And this is what the American education system has, the contemporary education system has promised us, you know? And so we absolutely
work hard and you will get that you have a shot at that golden ticket, whatever.
Yes,
that means.
And we need to remember that. And this is I compare Asian Americans to Jews in the 1920s, and this was the same case for Jews in the 1920s as well. We need to remember that there are so many parallels between these two groups. You have this rise of immigration in the early 1900s, and you have the ushering in of this new group that's competing against the new elite. That's exactly what's happening here. The change of immigration laws in the 1965, and you have now a new Asian population, many of whom are very highly educated, and now they're competing for these highly, you know, highly selective spots. And so this is really, and whether you're highly educated or not, or, you know, whether you're a restaurant worker, you know, this idea that education is going to be your ticket to mobility, this is something that Asians very much believe in. It's interesting because if we compare Chinese in a place like Spain, the majority, their educational outcomes, the educational outcomes of Chinese in Spain are far lower than the educational outcomes of Chinese in the United States because they don't have the same kind of educational opportunity structure there. So this is very much, you know, this is very much a strategy.
This is a fascinating terrain. You can hear the wheels of demography and power and expectation turning. Everybody challenged to pull up their socks here. Carolyn Chen in Evanston, we're grateful to you for your piece and for joining us this hour from Northwestern. Thank you so much, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Rod Bugarin in Denver, Colorado with Aristotle Circle. Thank you very much, Rod.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And David Hollinger at UC Berkeley. We'll check in again. Thank you so much for your thoughts today, David.
Okay, Tom. Bye.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.